You're listening to the Converge Podcast Network.
This podcast is being brought to you by SecureGive, pioneers in digital giving to help fuel and fund the ministries of churches and nonprofits all over the country. Hey guys, welcome back to Coffee with Preachers. I'm sitting down with one of the coolest guys I know. This is Grant Skeldon. He is just a fascinating leader within the kingdom. He is the founder of the Initiative Network, the author of The Passion Generation, just a really dynamic young leader and preacher and innovator and bridge builder within the body of Christ. And we're going to have a great conversation today. Grant, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, bro.
Really, I could spend the whole 30 minutes just asking you tips to help me be cool, because I'm like the least cool person.
You're not.
And you just exude coolness, right? And so maybe on a separate issue, you could give me some tips on just how to dress and not look like a frumpy old man, which is kind of my style, but I'm kind of just owning it.
Good. You own BU.
You got to be you.
That's cool.
But we've got more important things to talk about. And really, it's hard to know where to start, because there's so much you're doing. There's so much you have done already at your young age. And it's just fascinating to me, in a very good way, to see how you bring people together across generations, across denominations, across ethnicities, across all these different kind of structures and barriers our society and even sometimes our churches build up. And I love that. So maybe just kind of starting there, like what do you see as some of the keys of bringing people together? And in your own words, being a disruptor of division, which I just love. I love that. So how can churches be a disruptor of division and bring more unity?
It's funny, you know, actually I haven't talked, how can they? I think that one of the biggest places to start is being secure in who you are. Because if you aren't, and because if I'm talking to pastors, like if you're not secure in who you are, you're not going to really want to work with other pastors at other churches.
Oh, yeah.
And it's already hard enough. I mean, we're in Dallas. I can't tell you how many pastors get told, man, this, we were just at the, like for you guys, we were at the XO conference, and this is what Gateway's doing, and or this is what Watermark's doing, or The Village doing, or some church down the street is doing. And it can get hard if people often, I mean, just like in marriage, I can't imagine if my wife was like, this is what this husband's doing, this is what this husband's
right.
doing, this is what this husband's doing. I never disliked that husband, but now I'm like, dang, you're like,
I hate that guy.
Yeah, I know.
That jerk.
And so that's not on the pastors. That's on people comparing pastors publicly and saying you need to be more like those people. But being secure in a kind way of like, hey, maybe I can learn from that. But also sometimes like, hey, that's not who I am, but I love that God's using them in that way. But I have found, I mean, I do think at the core sometimes of disunity is insecurity. But if you really are secure with who God's called you to be, and one I think I say to young leaders a lot is one of the biggest lessons you can learn is how to be confident in who you are and comfortable with who you're not. And I think for young people, we're trying to be like all types of things, but being comfortable with, I'm not good at that, or I never will probably do that, but I'm so okay when someone else does do that, or even confident when someone does what you feel called to do better than you, more than you, and in front of more people than you. But if they're on the same team, like the security to say, I just love that they're getting to do what they're called to do, and they're walking in a manner worthy of the calling which they've been called. I'm walking in a manner worthy of the calling which I've been called. And when they win, I win, because God wins and we're on the same team. But it really does come down to security in Christ and who he's called you to be.
Man, that's good. How'd you get so wise at 28 years old?
Older people. I'm serious, man. I mean, a big part of my story is I got saved March 8, 2006 in Grapevine, just near where we are right now, and I didn't want to be a Christian. I was there for girls. I was single for the first time in 3 years, and I heard about this youth ministry that was huge, had 600 kids at the time, and I heard the gospel in a way that was relevant to me in that time. Gave my life to Christ, kind of reluctantly. I didn't tell anyone for 2 weeks because I had seen a lot of kids go to camp and cry and then not come back and they're the same 2 weeks
right.
later. And I was like, which I do like. I came from more of an urban area. And what I like about kids from urban communities is there's a necessity for real, raw like you can't fake it. And so for me, I was like, if I'm going to be a Christian, I want to really do this, but I don't want to be a fake Christian. And so waiting 2 weeks and telling no one, one, I realized God was moving in my heart because I started feeling bad about things that, like talking about girls. I was like, my friends were talking about girls and I thought, they're not saying anything new, but I feel like this is wrong.
Right.
Now.
Experience of that conviction for the first
time. Yeah, it was the first time a Christian lyric from a song connected with me. It was, I still don't really remember who. It's like, what's going on? It's the, I want to be in the light as you are in the light.
Yeah, DC Talk.
DC Talk, okay. So it was, what's going on inside of me? I despise my own behavior. And I remember hearing that lyric. My mom would always play Christian music and try to force it on us. And I was like, dang, that lyric is so true. Like, what is going on inside of me? I despise my own behavior. And so I was like, dang, God got me. Like, this really, if I keep trying to live the way I used to live, I'm either going to hate it because God's changing my heart, or I can just go all in and try to, like, clearly, I mean, it was a real conversion. But the biggest thing, I say the biggest day of my life was March 8, 2006, when I gave my life to Christ. But 2 weeks later, I got something that very few people got, is I had a man named Kevin Batista like reach out to me, who was a youth pastor of that ministry. I didn't know that when he reached out to me. And he just said, hey, I see the neighborhood you grow up in. As he started talking to me, he said, I say you gave your life to Christ and no one really knows you at the church. And I told him, yeah, it was my first time. And then he asked me about my dad. He's like, well, your dad's not a Christian. And he said, I'd love to disciple you and mentor you, because I think it's going to be really hard for you to be a Christian at your school, because we try to reach that school all the time and it's just, it's rough. And so that was a game changer for me, to have a man who was about 12 years older take me under his wing. And I just was like, I thought that was normal Christianity, was you get saved and then you get discipled. It made sense in the Bible.
Right, it's what happens in the Bible, but sadly it doesn't happen nearly as much.
No, and I got older and I realized, oh, so you didn't get discipled. You didn't get discipled. Most of my friends didn't get discipled. And so when you ask, where did I get wisdom? People say wise beyond my years. I usually say because I had mentors, not just peers. I had these older guys. I would even say sometimes to a fault, I enjoy being around older people more because, they think differently. They live differently. Young people alone are like Lord of the Flies, which I've said before. They're asking each other for advice on things, which they should just seek wiser people, older people.
And I do. I'm so with you. I think that's one of the things we're missing in the modern body of Christ, is we so just surround ourselves with people in our exact season of life.
Yeah.
And we miss out on the fact that we should be learning from those who are older and wiser, and then we should be pouring into those who are younger. But when there's this kind of generational isolation, then discipleship doesn't happen. Mentorship doesn't happen. And so you're a great success story for what it can look like. And now you're doing this. I mean, you're already intentional about, you know, reaching out to those younger than yourself and bringing them along.
And I would say that's a culture of Christianity or God. I mean, if you look at the Bible, most of the stories don't happen when people that are similar to each other hang out with each other. That's literally where that's like a country club. That's where like the same old stuff happens and everyone knows it. Like, stories in the Bible are when like Peter goes to Cornelius and it feels wrong. Like, am I allowed to do this? I like that kind of stuff. I call it like fearful, exciting obedience. It's kind of like, I'm a little scared. Am I allowed to hang out with this person that believes this way or does this or whatever? But I'm kind of excited because this is like where God does crazy stories and you get to see him show up in unique ways. But Peter with Cornelius or the Ethiopian eunuch,
doing? Those two had nothing in common.
God
went out of his way to bring them together.
I mean, Jesus being called a friend of sinners. Like, Jesus was often criticized for being, was like, what are you doing with those people? And I think if you're not hanging out with people different than you, then, I mean, in some way you're missing what Jesus was all about.
And that is a good word. I had never thought about the fact that so many of the great interactions in the Bible were specifically with people from two different cultures, two different backgrounds. That's gold.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to like read my Bible through that.
David. I think of the guy that kind of asked for healing and he's like, but he doesn't feel worthy of it. And I think it's a guy, it might be a female, and he said, even the dogs get to eat from the scraps. Like, God, I just think Christianity is so boring when you just hang out with people that look like you. And I'm talking about age, race, denomination, socioeconomic background. Like, you want to see God show up in big ways? Don't be around everyone that looks like you. Heaven will be a shocker if you just hang out with people that look like you. You're going to be like really depressed or shocked to be like, wow, the rest of my life will have to be very different than now. And so for me and my group, I have a group of 72 young leaders every year, 8-month program from 50 different churches. And I was like, why are we going to wait till heaven? Like, clearly there's benefits to this. And I think we're trying to respond to it now. We're like, let's do racial reconciliation. Let's do all this. I think it's not something we have to respond to because of crisis. I think we do it when we're younger because of Christ. And it's just better.
Man, that's so good. And that leads into something that you are just masterful at, and that is we live in a world where so many churches, they just refuse to kind of play nice with other churches, so to speak. It's kind of, everybody's got their own thing going, and it's so hard to get Christians and ministries and churches to work together, it seems like.
Yeah.
But you found a way, it seems like, to crack that code and bring people together across denominations, across ages, across a lot of different barriers to put together events or to put together things where there's rallying around one vision. And so few people have been able to do that. So what's the key? Because Christ obviously, you know, prayed for that. He prayed, Lord, let them be one as we are one. And yet we've never been more divided. So what is the key to kind of breaking down those walls of division?
I think a significant time together around, it's hard, man. I just have fun. Like, I don't know.
People
like,
love fun.
Just have fun. I can't believe how many conferences are on Unity. I'm like, oh my God. If you're the marriage guy, like, if you and your wife actually were having issues, let's say it's gone for like, especially if it's gone on for years. I know a relationship would be very hard for it to even, you would never let it go that long. But if it happened for years, like for racial tension or even denominational division, all this stuff, there's decades of history there. You wouldn't say, okay, how are we going to fit in a marriage if there was years of tension? You wouldn't say, let's do a conference together. And or worse, they're like, let's do a panel on reconciliation. You're like, you're going to say, let's do a vacation. Let's do a counseling. Let's like, let's get away. I think we always like just, we do so many panels. I say there's a panel for every problem. Like anytime there's a problem, we need to have a panel about that. And that's great. That's how pastors think, is they got to do a conference and then they got to do a panel. There's just, I don't actually build any sincere, strong friendships usually through doing these panels. Like, usually a black guy, a white guy, I get to be the Mexican guy, and then there's an Asian guy. If we know each other, it helps a little bit, but a lot of times we don't even know each other, and we're trying to fix racial tension for decades. And so I'm not saying all those are good intention things to do, but if I would, what I try to do, like what I found is I try to do retreats, mission trips, go see Israel together. Like, there's, I would say I've stumbled into this. I was very lucky to go to a very racially diverse school, and mostly African American and Mexican. And then when I got saved, it was very divided. It was either white church, black church, or Mexican church. So I realized, in a sense, like, my world before Christ was more diverse than my world since Christ. I had now have to be a reconciler to bring people together. But like bars and clubs I went to, they were more diverse than churches. And so to me, it was kind of like when people ask me, why do I care so much about it? I was like, because the world's better at it, and because heaven will be like that. And second, I would say, especially on the, was if talking about racial tension, if this generation, the Z generation, is even more diverse than millennials, if they grew up in diversity their whole life and then go to church and they don't see diversity there, it's kind of going to disqualify the power of the gospel when it's technically the ministry of reconciliation. So I think it's very important. So what I do, and I don't know if you ever noticed this, I put this in the last chapter of my book, but have you ever noticed that most movies on racial reconciliation, like stories, true stories, they're actually sports movies. Like Remember the Titans, The Blind Side, Glory Road, 42, Race on Jesse Owens.
Yeah, that's so true.
They're almost always sports movies. Sometimes they're not, like Hidden Figures is another one. It's not a sports movie, but it's always like people spending significant time together, actually connecting on what brings them their passion.
They're working together towards a common goal.
More than they dislike each other, they want to win at something. Or in Hidden Figures, they want to get the rocket into the moon. They want to win a football game. They want to win a basketball game. They want to win the race for the 36 Berlin Olympics for Jesse Owens. Like, they have a shared goal, but it's that significant time together. And so I started doing retreats, and I've luckily also got in a place where I can nominate people to go to Israel. Not everyone, just some people that are like very young influencers. And so I started nominating very diverse people that would never have time together, and say, if there's one place we could agree, it's like Jesus at this location changed all our lives. How we now interpret that denominationally is different, I guess.
Right.
But we can all agree Jesus Christ changed our life. And so it's been crazy to see what happens when you put people in relational experiences, so that by the time we then have conversations about how we're different politically, socioeconomically, racially, I have friendship as the foundation, and we're in Israel. Like, I'm stuck with you for 10 days. I'm not just trying to get a one-off to hurt you. And
right.
Anyway, I just love the cross-pollination. I would say keyword cross-pollination that comes out of starting with relationship. And it just can't be like a one panel or a conference. It's got to be a lengthy amount of time. But God's going to connect his people. Like, we have a lot more in common than we don't.
Man, that's so good. This podcast is being brought to you by my good friends at SecureGive. Some of my best friends on the planet founded the company of SecureGive, work for the company of SecureGive. There is no place like it. These guys are the real deal. In my 10 years living in Augusta, Georgia, where SecureGive is located, I got to see up close, firsthand, just how honorable these guys really are. SecureGive, they have been pioneers in digital giving to help fuel and fund the ministries of churches and nonprofits all over the country. Every church, every nonprofit needs a digital giving solution and strategy. SecureGive has a full-scale ecosystem to help you reach every donor, every giver, and maximize every donor and every giver through a variety of services, including online giving, text-to-give, kiosks, mobile apps, and a variety of other services that are going to help you reach the people that call your church home and continue to fund and fuel the mission and ministry of your church. SecureGive is ministry-minded. They love the local church. They employ people that serve and love the local church. They actually have a pastor, a retired pastor on staff whose whole job is to pray for and encourage the churches that SecureGive serves. I dare you to find any other digital giving company with that kind of ministry mindset. Man, SecureGive is the real deal. I love these guys, and I'm truly honored to call them friends. Do yourself a favor and look them up. Give them a call. You're going to talk to the same people every time you call. They're going to treat you like family. So go to SecureGive, SecureGive.com, SecureGive.com, and let them take care of you.
Marriage is your most sacred relationship on this earth, and prayer is the single most powerful way to transform it. Have you heard of Mark Batterson's book, The Circle Maker? Over 1 million prayer lives have been changed through The Circle Maker. Now marriages can benefit from this teaching as well. It's time to learn the relational truths in the legend of Honi the Circle Maker, a man bold enough to draw a circle in the sand and not leave it until God answered his impossible prayer. Honi's prayer saved a generation, and your prayers can transform your relationship. Praying circles around your marriage draws from the life-changing principles Mark Batterson outlines in his New York Times bestseller, The Circle Maker. This new book is available everywhere you buy books. Go check it out. And now, let's get back to the show.
Sadly, I think so many churches, they look at differences first, and they just miss out on that unifying message of Christ around the gospel, that, you know, he unifies us. And then specifically as it relates to millennials, I think churches stand back and they kind of judge and condemn and critique the millennial generation without really engaging them and listening to them. And like, you know, you've said so wisely, we don't have a millennial problem, we have a discipleship problem.
Yeah.
And so what for church leaders right now that are listening and they're like, man, I want what you're describing. I want diversity in our church or our community, our organization, whatever it might be. I want to reach, you know, millennials. I want to learn from them. I want to tap into their passion and their energy and their perspective. I don't know where to start. I don't know, because I've gotten so deep into this rut of surrounding myself with people who look and think and act like me that I really don't even know where to begin without it seeming inauthentic. So where do you begin?
I mean, when it comes to the next gen, yeah, we don't have a millennial problem. We have a discipleship problem. So find one young, hungry person and disciple them. And what I mean by that is include them in your life. I say discipleship is not come and meet with me, it's come and follow me. Mentorship is come and meet with me. But have someone follow you, join you into maybe your work life, your family life, your personal life, or your church life. And I say it's not adding something to your calendar, it's including someone in your calendar. And so my book like really lays out like six chapters. The first six chapters are practically what does discipleship look like? Because one of the biggest issues is, yeah, we're not making disciples. Like Barna found that only around 12% of Christians have a regular meeting with someone younger in the faith to pour into them, which I would still only say is mentorship. They found that only like 2 to 4% of people are actually discipling. And so again, we have a huge discipleship problem. And so millennials will be the last of our worries in the next 5 or 10 years if we don't take it seriously, because then it's going to be a Z generation problem. Then it's going to be, they're calling the next group an alpha generation problem. And so the core issue is our lack of discipleship. And I want to normalize discipleship because it was what Jesus told us to do. It's what he focused on the most. It works. We're here because of it. I don't know what else to say. If Jesus isn't enough, I don't understand why this is like, why I'm convincing Christians to do what Jesus said. Anyway, I know that's kind of harsh, but
no,
it is
it.
Real.
I've been guilty of that. I mean, I think we fall into this rut of, you know, when I was in full-time pastoral ministry, I'm doing marriage ministry full-time now, but it's just, it's easier to program and it's easier to plan worship services than it is to try to plan discipleship. And I think sometimes we human beings, myself, I've been in this group, we navigate towards those things with these measurable metrics that we can like wrap our mind around and say, okay, success is if this many people show up to this event or, you know, whatever it might be. And with discipleship, it's so important. I think maybe one of the reasons we take a step back is because we don't know how to measure success in it. Because relationships, there's not this metric, there's not a scoreboard, even though relationships are what life's all about, it's what's most meaningful. But because we don't have that, maybe a tangible way to measure how we're doing in it, people just sort of take a step back and say, well, I don't know where to start, so I'm not going to start at all.
Yeah, I know this is crazy hard metric, especially if people, which most haven't discipled anyone, but one of the easiest metrics is, have you discipled someone that is now ready to disciple someone? Because then you know, have I poured in enough to you so that you feel confident to pour into someone else? I mean, then you might say, what's next? Have you poured into someone who's poured into someone who's poured into someone? Like, I mean, if we looked at our story, like, where does our faith journey come back from? For me, it was Kevin Batista. Well, who did God use to grow Kevin Batista? And then who did God use to grow that guy? Eventually, like somewhere it's getting to Jesus, like Jesus and one of the disciples. Like, and so we have a faith journey that leads back to a discipleship start somewhere. And so anyway, discipleship's awesome. Diversity's awesome. Like these things aren't things I want to guilt anyone into. You're missing out.
This is the ticket. I mean, even for you Star Wars nerds out there, like every Jedi has a Padawan, right?
Seriously, dude.
and within the Christian church, like if we would just look at it just that way, I mean, like George Lucas isn't our example, Jesus is. But like he's onto something. Like if you're going to pass on that kind of wisdom, it takes that kind of intentional, you know, mentorship, and you're constantly in that process. And you know, even in those movies, you keep a Padawan until that Padawan was ready to have their own Padawan. And then, you know, I'm sounding like a total nerd right now.
No, you do. So you're so spot on. I wrote in this in the book for a little short piece. In an ideal world, I would have done a whole chapter on this, but like this is really big to me. And it's not a really known book, but there's a book. Have you ever heard of the book Joseph Campbell's book? It's called Hero with a Thousand Faces.
I don't think so.
Yeah, and Christian circles, I almost never heard of it. I love movies. Like I love behind the scenes. I love the making. I love the like casting. I don't know why. I just love it so much. And this is a huge book in. For directors and for filmmakers. It's called Hero with a Thousand Faces. This book influenced Star Wars so much. If you put in Hero with a Thousand Faces Star Wars, there's so much on how it influenced George Lucas. Yeah, the guy who wrote it. And it influenced Disney a lot as well. And basically the concept is like in every story, there's someone young who has this like angst to be part of something big. They feel like they're special or unique, maybe, but they're in this like difficult time and they run into a wall and they just want out. They're different. They want to be different. They feel different. And there's this game changer scene in every one of those stories where someone, Obi-Wan Kenobi or Maui for Moana, or like there's not a movie.
The guide.
Like there is, yeah, they call him the sage. Like there's some type of sage who's like the Mr. Miyagi who takes that person and elevates them. And now they still have challenges, but it gets to a part where that person kind of even surpasses their leader. But there's not a Star Wars movie, to my knowledge, that doesn't have young person, whether it's Rey now or Luke Skywalker before, that has a young person, then some type of older guide, sage, that's like changes the story completely. And so to me, I was like, that's just woven into the Bible too.
Yeah, it's part of us as human beings.
Exactly.
We entertains us and what drives us and everything else to point us back to discipleship, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, to say, this is what you're wired for.
Yeah.
And yet we still ignore it.
Yeah. I think our hearts long for it. I think I joke in the book, I say, most of us are just, we're not born again believers. Now we're just bored again believers.
Yeah.
Because we're in this stuck process of, okay, Christianity is just going to church this week, the next week, and the next week, and the next week. Maybe at best bring as many people as possible. But I'm like, that's not the scorecard. Like, that's a part of the scorecard, but the scorecard is go and make disciples. And so I think where a lot of us are bored, because in the book I say, like, painters that don't paint, I bet they're really bored. Like, dancers, yeah, that don't dance, I bet they're extremely bored. Disciple makers or disciples who don't disciple, yeah, they get bored. And then we just turn into believers. We believe this is true, but not enough to actually go do it. And I don't think there's a desire not to obey. I just think, unfortunately, we're in a place where the American church especially, it doesn't feel normal for us to disciple. And I really want to change that, where if we could normalize discipleship, where every Christian feels like, I'm not just here to consume, I'm here to reproduce.
Man, that's so good. That is so good. So what are some final words of wisdom as we kind of prepare to wrap this up? Because, I mean, I could talk to you all day about this. But, yeah, you know, what are some kind of final nuggets for people that are ready to put some steps into action, whether they themselves are or millennials or younger, or maybe they're part of the older generation? They want to be part of discipleship. They want to follow that biblical mandate. Maybe they're part of a church where that isn't valued, or they don't know where to begin. But where do we begin? I think that sometimes we overcomplicate it. So yeah, where do you start?
I'm going to speak more to the younger leader, or just anyone. I mean, I think even if I was 40, 50, 80, there's someone who's 10 to 20 years ahead of me that knows kind of, okay, well, how do I prepare for this stage of life? And so you always should be getting discipled as you're discipling, ideally, if you can. And so what I would just say is, yeah, who is someone that if you're looking to be discipled, because most don't feel qualified to disciple because they've never been discipled, well, then who's someone who's doing something similar to what you want to be doing in the future that's 10, 20 years ahead of you? And it could even be 5 if need be, but like, who can you find? I mean, one quick story I'll share is, the guy who's currently discipling me, it's been almost 2 years now. He's just, sometimes you want to learn how to do something from your disciple, and sometimes you want to learn how to be something.
Sure.
This guy, he was so humble, even though he's such an influential man in business and in the marketplace and in nonprofit work. Dude's crazy influential, but he never, you know, when you meet someone who's just got so much influence and power, but they carry themselves like a normal person, almost like even less, like they want to serve you. I just wanted to learn from this guy, like, how do you have so much humility in who you are? And so the hard thing is, he's crazy busy, which is always the number one excuse for why people don't disciple, is they're just too busy, which is true, they are. And so what I ended up doing after a year of just getting a meeting with him, I was like, okay, I need to approach him more for discipleship. How can I find a way to include myself in his life or join his life? And I knew that he liked running a lot. Like, he likes running in the morning, usually Tuesday mornings and Thursday mornings. Now is when he runs, but he liked running early in the AM. Like, now we run at 6 AM. Well, he told me, I said, hey, I'd love to run with you. I'm trying to get into running. And he said, yeah, will you meet me tomorrow then if you're serious about it? I was like, absolutely, what time? And he said 4 a.m. He said 4. And so I was like, that's crazy. Yeah, like, I didn't say that to him, but I'm thinking, dang, I was hoping it was going to be like 6 or something like 7. Probably 6 is what I thought it would be. But 4, there's just something different about when you set your alarm.
Yeah, like
for
Amish
anything,
people aren't
3
even up
something
that early. That's hardcore.
I didn't even know Amish people get up early, but that's good to know. And so I wake up at like 3:50. Luckily, I'm pretty close to where he is. I got every minute of sleep I still could get, and I rush over there. And the craziest thing is, I could say and love to say that it was one of the best days of discipleship, but it wasn't the worst, but it wasn't the best. And the reality is, that guy didn't even show up. for hours. Like, I'm there at 4 a.m., and he didn't even, he's a no-show. And the reality is, he meant 4 p.m., apparently. And when I texted him, he said, I'm so sorry, man. I didn't realize that you would think it was 4 a.m. I totally meant 4 p.m. And it was just, like, crazy. But I say that to say now it's been 2 years, and if you want to disciple someone, like, find someone, like, be hungry enough to be discipled. Like, go and search and find someone who's doing what you want to do and fight to be in their life. Like, Elisha wasn't supposed to get a double blessing. Like, twice Elijah told him, stay here and I'm going to go and leave, basically. And he's like, no, as long as you live, I will follow you, is what he said. And I think a big issue also with discipleship is young people aren't that hungry for it. Yeah. They kind of want to learn, but they want it, like, to be quick. And it's like, are you hungry enough to do whatever it takes? Because for that guy, he left knowing, okay, this kid's like, we'll show up at 4 a.m. Yeah. If I ask him,
man,
to.
Man, that's hungry.
That's really helped him. I mean, we're going to Dubai, and this guy covered my ticket. That's not a cheap ticket, because he's now at this point, he believes in me. Like, he said, I want to invest in you as a leader. And so it's crazy in 2 years how far our relationship has formed, but it all started with, like, that hunger. Discipleship hinges on hunger on our end and availability on theirs.
Man, that's good. That is gold. Guys, listen, if you're not following Grant Skeldon, connecting to him, you're missing out on a wealth of wisdom. So connect with him. You can go to grantskeldon.com. That's GrantSkeldon.com. He's at Grant Skeldon on Twitter and on Instagram. And I'm trying to talk this guy into starting his own podcast, because it would be super cool, and I would listen every time. He's just got so much to share. So, Grant, thank you again for being on Coffee with Preachers. Thank you for all that you're doing in the world and in the kingdom, both the things you do on big stages and the things you do behind the scenes that nobody but Jesus sees. The world is a better place. The kingdom is richer because of your leadership.
Thank you, man.
Thank you. And thank you guys for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Coffee with Preachers, hosted by Dave Willis. This show is part of the Converge Podcast Network. For more information about this show, visit convergepodcastnetwork.com.